How did you first come to know Leo Strauss?
Well, I knew something about him before he even came to Chicago. When I was an undergraduate, or maybe in my MA program, although I was very happy being in the Hutchins College, I used to read catalogs of other schools as though I was looking for other places where I might study or have a better sense of the academic world. In those days, whatever the Office of Career Planning or whatever it was called in those days, it kept a library of catalogs in the Reynolds Club up on the second floor. So I would borrow catalogs and look at them. And I was thinking of something in the line of political science. I don't know exactly that was limited to that. And one day I picked up a catalog of the New School for Social Research. Someone whom I had known somewhat from high school, several years ahead of me in high school, had gone on and studied at the New School. And I guess the feedback I got from his younger sibs was that it was a very exciting place to be. So I looked at the catalog. And I didn't know these European teachers who were listed as giving courses. The names didn't mean too much to me. They were largely German refugees, occasional Italian, all refugees from fascism and Nazism. But one thing struck me. Somebody was giving courses with just the name of a person in political science or government or whatever it was called there. So although one wouldn't be shocked to read, in those days at least, that somebody was offering a course on Wordsworth or what have you, that someone would offer a course on Machiavelli or what have you like that, I had never seen that before, had never heard of it. And certainly there was nothing in Chicago that corresponded to that. Rather, there were comprehensive courses, history of this or what have you. So that stuck in my mind, that somebody was giving a course on Burke, pure and simple. And I don't recall any explanation of which works were being read. It was someone's thought as a package. And that person was Strauss. So I remembered that. I wasn't about to go to the New School, but I thought, what an unusual way of presenting the subject. So then when Strauss came, it was in January of what year?
1949, I believe.
1949, yeah. I was finishing my MA program at that time. And he came with very little announcement or fuss and bother, no blaring of trumpets, and proceeded to offer a course, I think, on the first and second discourses. So I thought, well, I'll sit in, see what, que pasa? Well, there were only three other people in the class, counting myself. And I was alarmed. First of all, there was no hiding. It was a big room. There were a total of four people around the table. And I wasn't prepared at that stage when I was working on a dissertation, on a thesis, to devote the time to reading these works, though, of course, neither of them is very long. So after a few meetings, I silently stole away. But I observed something. This is another kettle of fish. I don't know that the other two people in the class were especially stellar or risk-averse or what have you, because I left, knowing that I was neither of those. But then I saw him in the way he asked questions and the way he worked his way around and into and burrowing into a text. I could see that in two meetings. And I had nothing further to do with him until that May or June when I had a defense of my thesis, and he was going to be one of the people who was going to do it.
And your MA thesis was on?
On state control of science, not a distinguished work, which was raised in the context, for me, of hearings that Congress was having on establishing the National Science Foundation. I mean, all this was as a result of the huge investment in scientific research that went on under the name of the Manhattan Project and so on. But there was a theoretical issue there, too. And he asked, what would be the position of Plato on state control of science? So I said, out of my deep understanding of scientific inquiry, he'd be against it. And Mr. Strauss then said, you're mistaken. And then he asked, what would be the position of Plato with respect to the free publication of scientific results? Because that was one of the things involved in NSF research and so on, much debated at the time. And I said, confidently, he'd be against it. And he said, you're right. So does that mean I was batting 500? No, I don't think so. So those were my first engagements with Strauss. Subsequent to that June, I left school for a year. I thought I wanted to go to work in journalism, my true love. And that year that I was away, an enormous upheaval took place in the political science department. And that was expressed to me through the reactions of my friends, all of whom were considerably older than I. I'd been too young to be drafted in World War II, and all these fellows, and they were all men, had not only served in the military, but had served for a long time, some of them 6 years. So I was just a kid on the block. And that was the audience that Strauss met that September, that fall quarter of 49. None of them, as best I can recall, was a major in what used to be called political theory. They might have had inclinations in that direction, but they didn't pursue it, owing to a peculiar rule in the political science department about what fields you had to take preliminary examinations in and which fields you didn't. You didn't have to take a preliminary examination in the field in which you were going to write your dissertation. But that meant you had to take 4 other fields, one of which was political parties and behavior, which was taught by Avery Leiserson, who was very difficult to fathom what he was up to. He was interested in methodological questions, and his courses consisted usually of talking about of the variety of approaches adopted by the authors of this 2.5-foot stack of books that he would bring into class each time. So it got you into that. And how one would deal with questions that he might pose on the exam, the uncertainty of it, created anxiety in these men who, many of whom, had faced live ammunition. And as a result, they chose to write their dissertations on political parties and behavior so as not to have to take the prelim. So these students who were being trained in behavioral social science, political science, out of curiosity or whatever, or because they thought, well, we better scope out this fellow and see what kinds of exam questions he might pose, they were his audience. It was not an audience inclined in his favor. Not at all. The predispositions ran quite to the contrary. And I know this. I don't have to name names of these people who were friends of mine and were students at the time. They were very, most definitely, they weren't the ideal audience, but they were very smart. And in the course of that year that I was away, there'd been, he had won them over. He had shown something. And when you look at or listen to those old transcripts of his seminars in those early years, you will note they all begin with the state of the question in political science to right. which this particular character, name whom you will, might have something to say. So it was a piece of kalam, you might say, of defensive theology, that he would begin in this way to say, I'm not leading you up a cul-de-sac. I'm leading you up through a particular author or a particular work to something that will deepen and broaden your understanding of questions that you already think are important, or will lead you to see that the questions that you think are important are themselves too narrowly conceived, carry too much in the way of predispositions or even prejudices that keep you from seeing what's there. So when I came back, it wasn't any longer a question of, you know, 2 other students sitting with a teacher at an oversized seminar table, but rather wall to wall. I mean, here's the new dancing bear who can do all sorts of things. Come and watch. And they were hard questioners. It wasn't a monologue by any means. So that became a very exciting place, and not least because there were other teachers in the department, I think especially of Hans Morgenthau, but there were others, and of course those who were more dedicated social scientists whose approach Strauss didn't refrain from putting up in contrast to what he thought his particular author that quarter was proposing. I mean, Strauss was the soul of bourgeois respectability. I mean, he would never commit an incivility or anything like that. No snide remarks or anything of the sort. But by bringing up the issues in this way, it then turned out that when I sat in Mr. Morgenthau's political theory course, or modern political theory, I think it was called, questions came from the audience that 2 or 3 years before we'd never been raised in that setting. So intellectually, it was a very exciting time. Civilized confrontation, hard arguments, and I'd say that was all owing to Strauss, his willingness to take it on and to show another way.
I've also heard from those days that if the class were scheduled to run for an hour and a half twice a week, that in fact they would often run 4 or 5 hours, that he would teach and then begin taking questions and take questions until all questions were done. Is that the case?
Well, 5 hours suggests something heroic. I mean, I think he, and not only he, but some other people in the room might have had to visit the washroom in that period. But certainly, he started punctually, but never ended according to the canonical hour, as we say around here. I mean, one really had a sense that you were in hot pursuit of something really interesting and important. So it went on. So he might have begun at whatever the hour was, 2 or something like that in the afternoon, 1:30, I don't know. And at 5 o'clock, you know, it broke up. And then there were people who walked him home. They had more on their brain that they wanted to relieve themselves of. So, no, it was exhilarating. And as I say, there were hotly debated issues with which the individual students, these mature men, had to grapple. I mean, these are people, almost all of whom that I knew, were married and were having children and all that. I mean, they weren't sophomores. And he was saying something really destabilizing of their intellectual universe. That didn't mean that all of them were going into political theory, far from it. I mean, think about some of the best students, like Herbert Starry and some others who went into other things, Walter Burns. But the reach of Strauss's approach to political philosophy and to its history raised all sorts of disquieting, destabilizing second, third, and fourth thoughts about what they were doing and how they might go about it. So it was intense.
In these early years, was his teaching style what we've come to know through the transcripts, in which he would give the kind of introduction to the course that you mentioned, explaining the relevance of whatever figure he's teaching to our current concerns, whether in political science or society more generally, and then begin going through the text, whatever it was, one passage at a time, commenting on it, and then towards the end of the class, taking questions? Was that his general approach from the beginning?
Yes, but with one little difference. Yeah. At the first meeting, he assigned or accepted volunteers for the different sessions of the class. In other words, it was blocked out in his mind or on paper. We'll do this many pages or this so many chapters and so on at this meeting and then the next and the next and so on for the whole 10 weeks. And people would lay claim to making an oral report on that passage or section for that particular class. So it was an oral presentation of 10 minutes, and then they would submit a paper with it, essentially what they were saying. It wasn't a question of delivering it extemporaneously, but that was the beginning of each subsequent session before he turned to the passage. And he would have a few remarks, sometimes Delphic or whatever, when they talk about interpreting language about his response to the thing. And sometimes a student would raise a significant issue and he would address it. I mean, like someone like Seth Benedetti, he's going to say something that Strauss will deal with and will come back to through correspondence or conversation with him privately. So that's how each class began. About 10 minutes, a student presentation of whatever issues he found there. It could be a summary with questions or an interpretation or an avowed puzzlement about this and that. And then Strauss would respond briefly to it and then would go on with his own explication. What I'm remembering, because I sat pretty close to see how he was working, he had a small piece of paper. Waste not, want not.
Right.
Okay. Small piece of paper, a small stub of a pencil. And he had some things written on it. And then when he finished with it, he drew a horizontal line through it. So these were not yellowed notes to be retained and for further yellowing. They were the product of fresh readings, which is not to say that he didn't. He could have had spiral notebooks at home with many of his observations about text. I'm sure that's the case. But yeah, he knew what ground he wanted to cover in the class. And usually, it was a firm hand on the tiller.
Okay. Did his teaching improve over the years?
I can't say that. I think it altered because in later years when I had started teaching and he was still here, I would sometimes visit some classes. And I think he felt less obliged to make the connection to present-day issues in political science and just go into the work itself. You know, in a way, the novelty of his approach didn't have to be belabored. That ground didn't have to be won again and again when students got the hang of what he was doing. And of course, he was writing more too and giving these big lecture courses. So it was easier for students to figure out what it was he was doing and what he was aiming for. Mm-hmm. And certainly the lectures that led to Natural Right and History made things pretty clear through the solid example which you could follow and see. I don't know that he became better at it.
How do you think he understood his role as a teacher? Was there something in particular he was trying to accomplish?
I have to say that when I heard Heinrich Meyer on more than one occasion speak of Strauss as being intent on establishing a school, I found it counterintuitive. That's, or at least I wasn't conscious of that as a student. Well, I was a kid. What did I know? That he was trying to win over able students to this line of work. I say to this line of work as distinguished from to this way of thinking, to be sure. But I didn't see it as a school. He was trying to win over really good students. He had found something or recovered something or belatedly rediscovered something that was valuable, indeed, that was extremely important. And I think it's fair to say, minimally, this is not making too much of a claim, he didn't want it to die out with him. But I don't think it was an issue of a school the way there was the Chicago School of Sociology, Chicago School of Economics, though even they were not monolithic, right? Certainly true of economics. Or for that matter, the Chicago School of Political Science when Merriam and Gosnell and those people were here in the 30s. So maybe, you know, reading his correspondence to Jacob Quine and others lends some support to that view. But I didn't think of it as a school. And I still find it hard to believe that Strauss thought he was making a school because it puts him too much in the center. You know, it's a heliocentric view of the thing. And I don't think he expected that or necessarily wished it.
He didn't see himself as the last man left to keep classical learning alive, to keep Western civilization alive, something like that.
No, I think there were other claimants to that in the classics department. No, his manner was not such as suggested that he was seriously engaged in massaging his own ego. Not at all. The biggest person in the room lay in that book in front of us. And in that sense, we were all there to learn. Now, you could say, well, how artful of him. I mean, our deepest cogitations, and when I say our, I mean of the finest and most able students, that was kid's play compared to what he could do right then and there. But that wasn't the way it was presented. Not as a result of some belief about the limits of human understanding, but the notion is that we have to earn our conclusions, and it isn't obvious that one can do it in the short run at all, or even in the course of a lifetime. So that suggested a certain kind of modesty that I believe he tried to exemplify for more than prudential reasons.
So there was a modesty before the tradition, an unwillingness to call attention to himself, and in your view, no project lay behind his teaching, simply understanding something.
I would say that was what I took away from it, that was our highest calling, as it were. Who can read the hearts and souls of men? I mean, we don't know about that. You know, what his own ambitions were and And even if you find letters, there's a discount rate that has to be applied to everything. I mean, one of the things one learned about reading any of these authors was they're presuming a certain kind of reader. So Strauss wouldn't have been the last guy in the block to have thought about that in relation to what he himself was writing. That he was ambitious, you know, in terms of understanding, is testified by the rigor and dedication that he brought to his work. I didn't see it, and maybe that's a sufficient statement. I didn't see it. That's all.
During his lifetime, he would have heard people in political science departments begin referring to his students as Straussians, and his own students begin referring to themselves as Straussians, and even beginning to quarrel among themselves about the meaning of what it means to be a Straussian. Were you aware of him ever commenting in any way on this appearance of this new term, Straussian?
I don't know. I myself have never used it, except to say that I don't believe in it and I don't use it. The question of the closed sect, what Michael Zuckert calls the secret handshake, and all that, I think with respect to that, Strauss would have said, could have said, what Marx himself said, that he was not a Marxist, and Strauss could say he was not a Straussian. I mean, that people, when they get to see something like this, you know, might get a little giddy. Okay, we're into something that the rest of the world doesn't see. And no, it isn't a delusion, and it isn't an illusion, but the scales have been lifted off our eyes and all that. They can go pretty far. Okay, I think Strauss would have referred to that somehow as the behavior of young puppies, to steal a term from an author he admired. But I don't see it.
Good, okay.
And all these internecine quarrels between, you know, I mean, the taxonomy of, quote, Straussians, that Ernest Fort, in a review of Drury's book.
114.
Yeah, she missed some. I think that's the right approach. I mean, demolish it with wit.
Okay. Strauss was your thesis advisor?
Yes.
On political Zionism?
Not a distinguished piece of work.
Pinsker and Herzl?
Yeah, but that got me into, you know, when he broached the subject with me and so on. I mean, at that point, he could have written the book, more than the book. And he had, of course, traversed that ground in part. The advantage of the whole thing for me was that he led me beyond reading those five fat volumes of Herzl's diaries in German and Pinsker also in German, to Spinoza, and even more significantly for me, Maimonides. Mm-hmm. That was my introduction to Maimonides. And that was one of the reasons he suggested that as a theme, because he knew that I knew a certain amount of Hebrew and was at home with it. Not necessarily medieval Hebrew, but the technical vocabulary for that that had to be learned, leaving aside works on astronomy, was really not that great. So he thought I should... I think he probably thought that with respect to any student he was advising or who was consulting with him about a dissertation. Work from your strengths. If you know something, work with that. That introduced me to Maimonides, and that was the most significant thing about the dissertation, that it introduced me to Maimonides, for which I am eternally grateful.
So you sat down with him, and he said, Mr. Lerner, you should consider writing on political Zionism.
And gave me a few clues about the kinds of issues that might be involved there. The politicization of the understanding of what was the situation of the Jewish people and so on.
And so he gave you a few clues about what the topic might involve. Did that those clues involve the names of Spinoza and Maimonides?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you could read a more than adequate executive summary of the subject in his introduction to the English translation of Spinoza's Critique of Religion. It's all there and a thousand things more.
So he gave you a very specific topic and you took to it.
He offered something for me to ponder. He thought it would be within my capacities. That has to be a consideration too. I obviously thought that I could manage the linguistic burdens such as they were. And maybe he even thought, that's what I would think in giving advice to a graduate student. Mm-hmm. Maybe even thought that the student would enjoy the topic, really like it. But as it turned out, I did. So I was grateful for that.
Did he read any chapters as he wrote your dissertation?
No, he said, you know, write it. And mm-hmm. I mean, that didn't mean I was unable to query him about things I was working on. One quarter, I think, at least one quarter, I was his, quote, assistant. I was typing a chapter of natural right and history that he was dictating from his notebook, the chapter on Burke, or the subchapter. Wonderful chapter. And, you know, I mean, so we had occasions to talk. Then he and I met a couple of times over a text of Maimonides. And, of course, I attended those seminars that he gave at Hillel on Maimonides and so on. So there were plenty of occasions to check in with him about things that were puzzling. But on the whole, I didn't bother him much, and he didn't pester me, certainly.
Okay. And once you turned in the final draft, did he give you any comments?
I am sure he did, but I cannot remember them, among other things. I mean, doubtless he raised some points that would need, if not restatement, perhaps more amplification, because in my own timidity, I think I work toward minimalist prose rather than waxing. But there's no doubt that he read it with care. And as in all these things, I mean, his criticism goes to the heart of the issue. He wasn't distracted by trivia.
In addition to, I forget, either a lecture series of either two or three lectures at Hillel on Maimonides, also at Hillel he gave lectures that have come to be known as, you know, very famous articles, Progress and Return, Jerusalem and Athens.
Yeah.
Do you know how these events at Hillel House happened? Did he happen to begin lecturing there on Jewish topics or topics related to Judaism?
I would say it all stems from a very special relationship that Mr. Strauss had with Rabbi Pekarsky, who was the director of the Hillel Foundation at that time. Rabbi Pekarsky in some ways reminded me physically of Moses Mendelssohn, short, slight, hunched, a very winning, modest, highly intelligent person. And he and Strauss obviously got along famously. So there must have been some occasion when Rabbi Pekarsky perhaps proposed to Mr. Strauss, would you care to speak on this or something? And the fact that Strauss did and repeated again, tells you that he clearly enjoyed it. Not that Strauss had time on his hands. He obviously thought or was made to believe that it would be helpful and valuable, and not least to Jewish students, we could say perplexed Jewish students, but to others as well. So these were real occasions. SRO.
And I gather not just Jews were attending.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, that's even true in the seminar, that not just students attended. Frank Knight attended regularly some of those seminars.
Edward Schills
as well, right. They didn't come there to mock, though I'm sure they had reservations aplenty. And sometimes Knight would raise a question in the class, yeah. So I think that's the origin of those Hillel appearances. They were real events.
Okay. Do you think that Strauss's Jewishness was relevant to his teaching at the university, as opposed to his lectures at Hillel House? Did it matter that he was a Jew?
Well, in Hillel, I would say quite obviously, the very formulation, why we remain Jews, I suppose that's not a question posed by someone who is secure in his Jewishness. I mean, what, it wouldn't be a problem. You know, it couldn't be a why question. So that already suggests a stance or a platform from the outside looking in. On the other hand, the whole tenor of the argument is one of quiet pride in the Jewish heritage, which is not only the law and all that, but fortitude under persecution, which is presented as honorable in and of itself. I remember a line from one of those. After all, he said, we are not gypsies. In other words, we come with something. This is a politically incorrect remark. We come with a heritage of which we can rightly be proud, and in defense of which we need offer no apologies. It's not quite what Disraeli said in the House of Commons when attacked for being Jewish. Of course, he'd been converted as a child by his father. When my ancestors officiated as high priests in the temple in Jerusalem, your ancestors were wearing red paint and going around in animal skins. Let's not point there.
In a way, you've answered this question, but let me ask it. Did it matter to his Jewish students that Strauss was Jewish? Did his Jewishness matter to them?
He didn't conceal it. I mean, you didn't have to infer it from his surname or something like that. But of course, his seminaries were not taught from the standpoint of being Jewish.
Why do you think he wanted to move from the new school to here, to the University of Chicago?
Better job. Probably better students. More money. Right. The new school, all honor to it, was a special place. These were people who had been set adrift by terrible developments and found a resting place. Whether it was a home, I don't know. And here, in effect, when the president of the university makes a direct appointment to a department, I don't know whether the extent to which he did or did not consult with whoever was the chairman of the political science department at that time. That's big. It's meant to be a compliment, and I'm sure Strauss took it as such. Remembering, you know, that he was a stateless intellectual for whom the market demand is very slight.
I wouldn't have thought of it that way, but okay. After Strauss gave his lectures on natural right and history, and particularly after publishing the article Epilogue, he had not pulled his punches. He had staked out a strong, no-holds-barred criticism of the dominant school of thought in this political science department and other political science departments.
In the profession, you could say.
In the profession. How did his relationships inside the department fare over the years? I mean, was there a counter-movement against Leo Strauss here at the Department of Political Science among the faculty because they didn't like this criticism?
Now, what does that mean, the counter-movement? You mean, like, to expel him to Berkeley or somewhere?
To not want to have him around, to consider him perhaps a brilliant but troublesome nuisance.
Oh, I don't know. You know, I mean, my view of that world was that of Euclidean geometry, namely an earthworm. I wouldn't have known about that. That there were people in the department and some who became chairman who really viewed it as, I suppose with some measure of contempt and alarm, certainly didn't like the message, so to speak, the whole stance. That's a certainty. On the other hand, he attracted students, and there was no gainsaying his intellectual vigor. And in all these matters, Strauss was the model of a good citizen. You know, when I spoke, you might have thought slightingly of his adherence to the bourgeois proprieties. No, I mean, that's what you do. You remain on good terms with everyone with whom you have to be on some kind of term. Okay. You don't needlessly affront people and all that. The essays on the scientific study of politics edited by Herbert Storing, with these essays by various hands and ending with the epilogue by Strauss, that set out to be a critical, but it was expected that it should be a fair-minded assessment of the work of these leading figures, most of whom were still alive. Arthur Bentley was not, but Lasswell and Simon and so forth and so on. And I think a special effort was made not to diminish or patronize those authors, but to take them seriously and, figuratively speaking, to hold their feet to the fire. So it was a collection of essays that were critical in a very good sense, but the emphasis was on their shortcomings of these different approaches. But it wasn't snide or disdainful in any way. It elicited a most extraordinary review by Sheldon Wolin and John Shar. Very long, taking up, you know, the different essays and so on, and sticking it to them. And the editor of the APSR at the time invited a response. So altogether, you're getting a review and a response to review that probably added up to 50 pages, maybe more. And that whole thing, I mean, those are the drawing of battle lines. Finesse and politesse almost get lost in the clashes here. So that made a big stir, a really big stir. The book itself, the review, and the response to the review. So this was not passive obedience or something like that. I'm sure that heightened tensions, but it wouldn't have occasioned Strauss being expelled or something. But whether it had some bearing on how much of a guarantee the university was willing to give him that he would be employed beyond his retirement age, which at that time was 65 years, it might have, and it certainly had a bearing on Strauss deciding to leave the university after a couple of years beyond the retirement, I guess, because he didn't want to have that insecurity.
So that his decision to move to Claremont was partly he didn't want to be left at the pleasure of the departmental chair.
Yeah, and probably some combination of good sense and vanity. Not that he found happiness, but that's another issue.
Let me take you back to your dissertation thesis. Strauss proposed the topic of political Zionism and then showed you the way to Maimonides, and then that led to part of your career. You spent much of your life studying Maimonides.
Nibbling at the edges.
Okay. Did Strauss do more than just, let me try and make this question clear. If, for instance, you had been interested in Machiavelli, then in Strauss's lectures, he worked out a full interpretation of Machiavelli, depending upon which courses you're talking about. But he did give one or two courses here at Chicago on Machiavelli.
I remember one of those. Yeah.
But if you're interested in Maimonides, there was no such full architecture of how to approach this author. Did he, in your conversations with him, did he lead you along an approach to interpreting Maimonides or how to think about him or simply give you an appreciation for the greatness of this figure? Had you been aware of who Maimonides even was before you began this work with him?
Well, I knew something from Hebrew school because our composition notebooks had a fictional portrait of Maimonides, okay, but I certainly hadn't read anything of his. I mean, Strauss didn't draw my attention to what he had already written on Maimonides. Quite a bit. He had already written quite a bit in French and in German and, of course, in English. No, he said enough for me to believe, one, which was easy to believe, for me to believe, there was pay dirt there, and two, I might be able to dig a little out for myself. So it wasn't a question of, it wasn't presented as this. In fact, I would say, just about any of us, and now I don't mean Jewish students, students generally of Strauss, who come to a subject that he's treated, I would say we should be happy if we found something interstitially that we can work out. I remember a review, a very witty review that Harvey Mansfield wrote about someone's treatment of Machiavelli. And he said, you know, wherever you go on this island and you're checking out here and there, suddenly there appears a little coin box and it says, deposit coin here.
Leo Strauss was here.
That puts it beautifully. Okay. So then as I worked on things of my own, I would give them to him for criticism. Didn't matter that I wasn't enrolled in a course, needless to say. And he would read them with obvious intention and with enormous capacity for seeing where I was struggling to go and help me. And I would say the most extreme form of that was when I was working on a translation of Averroes' paraphrase of Plato's Republic. Very difficult Hebrew of a missing Arabic original. And I sent him my draft translation with hundreds of queries embedded in the text that had remained uncertain or highly problematic after I had consulted on those very points with Muhsin Mahdi and Shlomo Pinas. And he had to have spent many hours going over that manuscript and checking it against the Hebrew. And I was blown away by what he had invested in. And this is when he's ready, close to the end of his life, and weak, all kinds of physical conditions, and probably hustling as much as he can to finish work he has in hand. I know I wrote to him in a very different tone that a teacher would write to his teacher, and I think that letter he kept. It may be in the archives. So he was generous. He was certainly generous to me, and, you know, I wasn't his most promising student or the one on whom he placed the greatest hopes, but he gave of himself. I suppose some element of affection might have been involved, but, you know, I was one to tell.
Leo Strauss, in giving you your dissertation topic, showed you its connection to deeper things, in particular Maimonides thought and gave you an idea of what that thought might really be, and that there was a place for you there.
Yeah, and as a political thinker.
And that then after you began tilling that acreage, you found over the course of your career that there were not only writings by his that were helpful, but that he would respond as you had queries and you were working and give you feedback.
Yes, mm-hmm. Emphatically yes.
Yeah. The other great theme of your career has been the American political thought, American mm-hmm. founding, and Tocqueville. Did you ever discuss those topics with Professor Strauss?
Well, I'd been interested in constitutional law the way it used to be taught in those days. I can't recall that. Certainly, there were among Mr. Strauss's students those who worked in the American field. I already mentioned Herbert Storing and Walter Burns, and of course, Harry Jaffa.
Martin Diamond.
And Martin Diamond, right. So I detected nothing remotely resembling, well, these are guys who were, I mean, they're not slumming. They're doing this because that's about all they can do. It's not that at all. It was regarded, I think, as respectable, more than respectable work to be done by someone who was trained with an awareness of the larger context of thinking about political things. I did send him my writings on that, but, you know, I wasn't pestering him to help me work out some of the perplexities of American government policy toward Indians and stuff like that.
You were letting him know the itinerary of your trip, but not asking for guidance about where to go.
Right.
A remarkable thing, it seems to me, is that with you and Herbert Storing and Martin Diamond and Harry Jaffa...
And Walter Burns.
And Walter Burns, you had a real significant contribution to the understanding of America and American thought. And all of you were students of Leo Strauss, but Strauss never taught American things. It's not clear to me that he really had much to say about these figures. Was there a connection between studying with Leo Strauss and your reading of Tocqueville or your work on the Founders Constitution?
It's hard for me to say. Walter might have another response to that because he probably had Strauss as his dissertation supervisor, or one of them. Probably the first one was C. Herman Pritchett or Robert Horne. Wonderful teacher. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. This only expresses my awareness, but it may be an inadequate appreciation of the things that studying with Strauss brought to my study of American things. I would say the person who had most influence on me in thinking about American things was Marvin Myers, who was, in some odd way, a kind of fellow traveler of the Straussians with... Straussians, without being one of them. He was an extremely perceptive and subtle thinker, a one-book man, okay? And I studied his way of looking at things quite intensely for a number of years. But as I say, I sent Strauss everything I wrote.